Hi, I'm Paul Kwiatkowski. I'm a developer on the Windows team.
And I'm Paul Gallet. I'm a program manager on the Windows team.
And this is the third in a series of talks that we've been doing about the new Windows animation platform that's going to be debuting in Windows 7. And today, we're going to be discussing what we think are the most advanced features of the platform and explaining our thinking behind them. And walking through some of the stuff that you'll find in the SDK, but just to give you a little more detail on it. So we're going to divide the talk into four parts, discussing what we think of as the things that differentiate this platform. The first of these is what we call velocity matching, which is the ability of one animation to transition smoothly into another when it's interrupted. The second is context-sensitive duration. And by context-sensitive, what we mean is that an animation can take into account the initial value and the initial velocity of the variable that's being animated and set its duration accordingly. So that if an object has to just travel a small distance on the screen, then you get a very brief animation. And if it has to travel a large distance, it'll take longer. The third is contention management, and this is dealing with the whole problem of what to do if an animation is already in progress and the user presses a key. As we'll see, there's a few different issues there, and you have to make some choices in your application. And then finally, given the above three items, there's the question of how do you write plugins to use your own mathematical functions in your application if you want to. We do provide a library of a lot of basic ones and some interesting ones, but some application authors are probably going to want their own effects, but still want to take advantage of the other three features that we've just discussed. So to begin with, I'll just briefly define what velocity matching really is, because it's actually quite pervasive in the API, and so we'll be talking about it more as we proceed. You're typically going to have in your application animations that take a value from take a variable rather from some starting value and do something with it, some kind of effect, maybe just move linearly towards a final value or speed up and slow down. And usually we'll slow down to a halt at the final value, although that's not required by any means. But what happens if you have the user press a key and another animation has to start? Well, you certainly don't want to jump to the final value. And so, as expected, we will always, by default, take the current value where the variable is and start the new animation from that. But the most straightforward thing to do would be to have the second animation just do its own thing, start slowly and speed up, and then arrive at the new final value using whatever function it chooses. And what we do instead is we actually, in addition to having the initial value be a parameter to this second animation, we also pass in the velocity at that instant where it's going to begin. And so it can choose to ignore this, or the application can actually override the behavior. But by default, most of the transitions in our library and transitions that we expect third parties to write will pay attention to this velocity and use it as the initial velocity. So you don't get an interruption motion. The variable is moving and just continues moving, but might now head off to a different final value. And this is something that we don't expect applications to always do. By default, you'll get this behavior, but it might well be the case that if you have some kind of foreground item, just to make the application seem responsive, you'll want it to get a kick off in some other direction. And so we do have a method on our IUI animation transition interface, which is set initial velocity. And so you can override this to head off at whatever initial speed you think is appropriate. But for things in the background, we've been experimenting with it in our demos, and we think it gives a really nice effect. Things don't suddenly lurch off instantaneously. You get that same nice acceleration and deceleration that you want within a single transition happening across transitions, and we'll show you some of that. So the next topic is context-sensitive duration. this diagram here shows you a very simple transition. It's a very simple storyboard, but just this one transition on a variable called x. And what we have here is this is a linear transition in our library, which is going from whatever the initial value is to a specific final value and with a specified duration. So even if the object, its x-coordinate, is very close to its final x-coordinate, it's going to take exactly, say, 1 second or whatever is passed in for the duration. And so instead, we have a different method in our library API, which lets you create a linear transition with a speed parameter instead of a duration. And so at that point, when you specify the storyboard, the duration remains unspecified. And these diagrams are all from our SDK help. You can find them there. And you'll see that we're using question marks to represent the duration. And so even though we obviously have to choose some visual duration, the idea is that that's flexible. From one instantiation of the storyboard to the next, when you play it, you might find that the duration, or you will almost certainly find that the duration varies over time. And you can actually build up more complex storyboards. In this example, we're now appending a second transition storyboard to the first one, and we're assuming in this example it also has a context-sensitive duration. So now we have two unknown durations adding up to, of course, an unknown overall duration for the storyboard. And when things get interesting is when you add keyframes. As this illustration shows, you can add a keyframe at a fixed offset in the storyboard, and all a keyframe is in our API is it's a moment in time, an offset from the start of the storyboard, and you can use it to then start other transitions at that instant, or you can actually stretch transitions in between two keyframes, or you can cycle between two keyframes. And so the straightforward case where you specify a fixed offset, you get the familiar behavior of plotting out an animation that's going to take so long for the first thing to happen, and then other things happen at a specific time into the storyboard. We also have this API call, which is add keyframe after transition. And so now you're defining a keyframe's placement in terms of a transition's duration. And if the transition has a fixed duration, then again, you've got a keyframe at a fixed position. But if you have one of these keyframes, or rather transitions, with an unknown duration, then now you have a keyframe with an unknown offset in the storyboard. This isn't actually determined until the storyboard is playing. And if you use the same storyboard and play it multiple times, then the keyframe placement might vary from one playing of the storyboard to the next. And so that's what we're showing in this diagram with the we're using a question mark to show the offset of a keyframe as well. And we've also used this notation of these little arrows inside the transitions to show at the bottom there's a transition whose beginning is determined by that keyframe it's up against. And higher up, you can see an arrow at the end of a transition that shows you that the keyframe's position is determined by the end of the transition. And just to flesh out the example a little more, here's a keyframe. Here's a transition that is being stretched in between two keyframes. You can do that by calling add transition between keyframes. And what we'll do is we will force the duration to be whatever the separation of those two keyframes is. And if that's a transition that has a duration parameter, then we expect it to also implement the set duration method. We'll talk about this in more detail later. And we will override it. And if it's a transition that doesn't have a duration parameter, we will actually warp time behind the scenes just to stretch it out or compress it down as appropriate. And again, the ultimate duration of this transition can vary from one playing of the storyboard to the next, depending on where those keyframes end up. And so this just shows that the exact same storyboard can actually end up looking quite different when it sees different initial starting conditions in these variables x, y, and z. That's the exact same storyboard if you look closely at all of the dependencies. And so again, it doesn't really have a look. The storyboard is actually much more abstract until it plays. So what we've done is we built it up showing one set of initial conditions, but then we have another diagram showing that it could turn out completely differently. And there are, you know, some keyframes are in a different order, and a different variable ends up getting held at the end than the first scenario. So we'll actually show a demonstration now, which we actually showed in our first talk, but we didn't really talk about what was going on. So.
Right, yeah. So what we have here is our grid layout demo that we showed in our last webcast. And what we're doing here is, as we resize and we relay out the grid of photos, is first we calculate the difference on the x and the y coordinates, and then we compare them. Whichever one is longer, we create a parabolic transition. And then for the shorter distance, we create a accelerate-decelerate transition. Now, the cool thing here is for the accelerate-decelerate transition, it has a fixed duration. And for the parabolic, it's a context-sensitive duration transition. And so when we schedule the storyboard here, we create two keyframes, one for the starting point of the parabolic and for the ending point, and then we actually say stretch the accelerate-decelerate transition in between. So that fixed duration transition actually becomes context sensitive, as we showed in the previous slides. And so what you do is you get a fixed duration interpolation, but in a context sensitive way. So this way, each of the photos, when we resize this grid here, you get kind of a smooth transition, because you also see the velocity matching, because you get that for free. But the photos tend to get to their location when they need to. So not every photo will get to its desired location in 50 milliseconds. We'll make sure that with the framework is that based on the initial conditions for the initial value and velocity, we'll calculate the new position and interpolate to its values.
So as I mentioned, the next issue is contention management, as we call it. And this addresses the question of what happens in a user interface when you have animations in progress and then the user starts pushing keys or clicking mouse buttons or doing something else and wants to see a response to their actions. And this problem's introduced by having animations, in that if you have every reaction to the user's input be instantaneous, then there's never any contention. So if you do have an animation in progress, there's only so many options you have, really. One is to immediately interrupt the animation, have a new animation take over, and that's actually the default in the platform. So if that's good enough, you don't have to worry about contention management. You'll just get the behavior you want. But we felt it was very important to allow a couple of things to happen. One was that you might sometimes have to have an animation complete in order for the next one to be meaningful. A really simple example would be, say you have some object that you want to move around the periphery of the screen, and so if it's still moving up the left side, to your right, then you don't want it to suddenly cut across just to start moving across the top of the screen by animating the Y variable independently. You'd rather have the first animation complete. And there's going to be a lot more examples as people add richer and richer animations to their application, things that have to open up before something slides out, or something that has to arrive before it can then transform, whatever. And then once you support that, then this introduces the possibility of some sort of queue building up. And in some cases, if the user is really mashing on keys fast, some of the animations might actually become irrelevant. And so we wanted the ability to toss them out of the queue. If a person has pushed, say, the F key so that a menu bar slides out, and they're thinking the file menu is going to slide down, and then while the menu bar is still sliding out, they change their mind and say, oh, I want to edit instead. I want the edit menu, so they push the E key. We don't really need the file menu to show it all. We can just discard the animation and switch, you know, segue straight into the edit menu sliding down. And then in some cases where things just have to complete for whatever reason, and maybe a whole queue of animations has to complete to be meaningful. Perhaps you're showing a route along an atlas or something. We don't actually need to make the user wait for all of these animations to play out. So another option is to compress time so that the animations finish more quickly. And this is something we could have put as a burden on the application, but we thought this was better to have it as a system service because it's quite complicated to get it right. And then, and of course, the final option is that perhaps if the user is mashing keys too much, maybe you just don't want some of those commands to run. It's better to, they're just going to get themselves into trouble, and it's better to let the animations play along a bit further before you accept further keyboard input. So in order to do this, what we did is we wanted to take as much burden off the application as possible. And so we've distilled this down to these callbacks that we call priority comparisons. So we have an interface that you implement that has a single method, has priority, and we just call the application and say, here's a storyboard, here's another storyboard that's colliding with it, and can any of the following happen? Can we discard the first storyboard that was already scheduled if it hasn't started playing yet? That's cancel. Can we trim it? That's the interruption. Can we compress it? That's the last resort of squishing time down. And also, if it was an infinite loop, can we stop the infinite loop and have it exit gracefully, and then we'll start the storyboard playing? And we can also combine that with the compression. So the application registers up to four distinct callback interfaces for this. One other thing that's worth mentioning, which I'll show a little bit, is there's an enum, but it's effectively a flag that we pass in, which is called the priority effect. And this is a little subtle. What this means is the system is asking, can I, say, trim this other storyboard? And the priority effect is saying that if you say no, then the attempt to schedule the second storyboard might actually fail. That's that last scenario I mentioned where sometimes you just don't want the animation or the command to succeed. And the other value that we'll pass in is delay. And so what this really means is that the application has control over how aggressively we want to move animations into the schedule. Do we want to trim or cancel existing animations just for the heck of it? Just, hey, if it'll make things happen faster, that's great. And in some user interfaces, that really might feel appropriate. And in other cases, it's better to let animations play out, but only as a last resort to actually interrupt them. The central deciding factor in all of this is what we call the longest acceptable delay. And this is where the application specifies, either on a per storyboard basis, or there's also a global default that you can set, how long is an acceptable time before an animation plays after the user has hit a key. And we expect it to be just a few hundred milliseconds. But again, it'll probably differ from one domain to the next, and even from one part of an application to the next. So to show some diagrams here, what's the system actually doing with all of this information? That's what these diagrams are from the help. First of all, what we do is, after constructing a storyboard with all of these keyframes and transitions and so on, for the actual scheduling operation, what we're interested in is the outline of the storyboard. And so the subsequent diagrams, you're going to see these storyboards with these jagged leading and trailing edges. Whenever you see a jagged leading edge, that means that there was a keyframe and a transition that starts at that keyframe. That's the only way you can actually have a transition start at an offset into the storyboard. But we do think this is going to be a useful thing to do. So this is that same storyboard that we constructed in the last set of diagrams. Just here's its outline that we're going to focus on. And so now here's a sample schedule. So this is our pathological, crazy example for the help. If your application actually ends up in this particular situation, you probably want to go back and revisit your UI. It's getting a little bit too complicated and hard to use. But we want to be able to, of course, show one of everything for our scheduling algorithm. And so in this particular scenario, we've got these storyboards. They're labeled. I don't know how clear that is in the video, but the one coming in from the right is the one that we've just constructed. It's called the blue one, G. And we're assuming that for the particular set of priority comparisons that the application has registered, it's allowed to cancel storyboards C, that's the orange one at the bottom, and E, which is the green one up at the top. And it can only do this to prevent failure. That's, again, that priority effect parameter. We won't just do it for the heck of it, to move it up further. And likewise, it can also trim those two storyboards and also storyboard F, the red one in the center right there. And then we're also assuming that any storyboard can compress any other storyboard, and that's the default, and it's typically what most applications, I think, are going to want. Because one thing, if you're going to compress a storyboard, you need to be able to compress any other storyboards that are before it. And so it might lead to confusing behavior if you just have some compression. So it'll probably be an all or nothing thing, most likely all. So so what happens when we try to slide this in? Oh, and most importantly, I've got a dotted line there showing the longest acceptable delay in this particular example. We're going to walk through a similar example that has a different longest acceptable delay, and you'll see that things work out quite differently. So in this case, what's going to happen is storyboard F is going to get trimmed, and storyboard E is going to get canceled. And just from that cancellation, something interesting happens, which is that storyboards D and F actually get uncovered a bit. Turns out that storyboard E was trimming them, and we've just thrown it out of the schedule, so we're going to put things back the way they were before that storyboard was added. And we figured that was the most logical outcome. We considered the different ways we could handle this sort of situation. And so it might seem unexpected in this pathological example. I think generally it's going to lead to natural results most of the time. So now we have this slightly different landscape of storyboards that we're going to slide G into. And here's where we actually end up. So what happened here is because we didn't say that storyboard C, the orange one, can be trimmed just to avoid delaying storyboard G, that's actually become kind of a harsh barrier, hard barrier, where and so G is butting up against C, and that's as far forward as it needs to move, because we can see that its beginning is now within the longest acceptable delay, just barely, but it's within it. And so what's happened is F has been trimmed a little bit, but F is still playing on X. And if you look closely, those are the same starting conditions that we used in the diagrams for constructing the storyboard, just to show that's how it ended up with that particular shape in this scenario. So now we'll run the same scenario again, but this time with a shorter, longest acceptable delay. And so in this case, again, we're going to have to cancel storyboard E, the orange one, and we're going to have to rely on the fact that we can trim storyboard F, and we're also going to cancel storyboard C, because now, in order to prevent failure, we have to cancel it, and so G now has higher priority than C in that regard. So what happens is G can trim F, but it doesn't have the priority to trim D, so it's bumping up against it. However, it's still not there, meeting the requirement of starting within this longest acceptable delay. And so now what we're going to have to resort to is this other option, compression. And as we said, every storyboard can be compressed by any other storyboard. So what we're showing here is the schedule just before we apply the compression, and that little arrow shows just how much we're going to have to compress everything by. And compression is transparent. You don't have to think about it when you're creating a new kind of transition. Instead, we just do some tricks behind the scenes with the time inputs that we're passing in. We actually accelerate time slowly up, and then we decelerate it so that you end up back at normal time speed, however you want to describe that, and we do we haven't lost continuity. All the velocities are matched, and so on. And so, have a good look at storyboards A, B, and D there, and also that little bit of F that's there. And we see that they've all just been squished down somewhat. And of course, now we've got the other set of initial conditions being observed by storyboard G, so it ends up taking on the shape that we showed in the last of the diagrams in the storyboard construction sequence. So we're now going to show you another demo from the SDK, and this one is all about these priority comparisons, and it shows you some of the behaviors you can get from these sorts of scenarios, but simpler than the ones in the diagrams.
Right. So what we have here is we have a series of photos displayed in an array, and as we press the back and forward keys, the one photo will move down, and the next photo will move up. Also, if you notice, the entire array of photos shifts over one from right to left. And so you can see as we start going through each of these photos, we traverse through, and it looks pretty good. Now, the interesting part that comes into is when you start button mashing, and you get that that compression effect. Also, you'll notice, too, is that the movement from left to right is independent of the compression. So that storyboard isn't affected at all by the compression. Only the storyboard that moves the photos up and down are affected by compression. And so this just shows that, you can have independent storyboards and all the priority comparisons don't have to be associated with them. Another interesting case. Let me get back to the center here. Is when we can actually move the entire set of photos through a wave here. And so what happens here in this storyboard is that we actually move the first storyboard or the current storyboard down. And then we move all of these subsequent photos through the wave, and then once the wave finishes, we move the storyboard, we move the photo back up. And so as we begin button mashing here, you can see that the wave will start getting faster and faster and more responsive to keyboard input. Another thing that you'll notice is that the current photo stays down throughout that entire process. Because that's do we cancel that one, or is that one
what we're doing is if you dig through the sample code, you'll see that there's actually two storyboards here. There's the one to slide down the current photo, and then to make all of the photos jump up and down, and then there's a separate storyboard with a different effective priority to bring it back up again. And so when you push the button, the down button in this case, repeatedly, that storyboard to slide the selected photo back up gets canceled. And because the transition to slide it down in the first place is a parabolic one, which is context sensitive, it now has, it's already down when the second storyboard starts, so it ends up with a duration of zero. And so as a result, you end up with this seamless transitioning from the end of one storyboard sine wave into the next storyboard sine wave. And you can do that repeatedly, and then once you stop and let it all slow down, then finally that second storyboard doesn't get canceled, gets a chance to bring it back up. So what you'll see is if you, when the photo, the selected photo is sliding back up, if it's just started to slide up and you push the down key, we will trim it and it will move back down immediately. Whereas if it's almost reached the top and you push down, it'll actually finish heading up to the top and then go back down. And if you look through the code, what you'll see is that for the most part, we ignore the priority effect. We say that just make things happen as soon as possible, even if the longest acceptable delay would be that, if that requirement would be met. If there's anything you can trim or cancel, go ahead. But in this one case, we said only trim that particular storyboard to prevent failure. And so once you do decide to trim a storyboard, or once the system does decide to trim a storyboard, then the storyboard's effectively transparent, and we'll just move the incoming storyboard as far as it can go until it hits another storyboard or until it reaches the present. But so if the storyboard has just started sliding up, then it becomes necessary to trim it, and at that point we might as well just start the next animation immediately. If, on the other hand, it's almost reached the top, we do have a finite longest acceptable delay there, and so your keystroke to move it back down again does wait a little bit, doesn't trim the storyboard, and that way you don't see an interruption. And just to go back to the independent X yep. animation, it's interesting what's happening here. This shows you the velocity matching happening very seamlessly in the background, in that when Paul holds a key down, then every single time we schedule a new animation, we're actually trimming the previous X animation. So this is, again, one of these parabolic transitions where it figures out how long is an appropriate amount of time to take. We've tuned it deliberately so that there's a lag, so you can really see this effect in this little sample application. But we're also repeatedly interrupting it. And that particular transition also pays attention to the initial velocity. And so you're getting a very seamless match where things just gradually speed up and slow down, even though it's actually many, many little storyboards, little segments. They all fit together precisely. And this is just to show you what's going on when you implement custom interpolators or custom transitions. If you're not interested in doing that, if you just want to use our transition library, or if, as we hope, third parties release some transition libraries, you just want to use one of theirs, then you actually don't even need to worry about the term interpolator. You can just create this or that kind of transition. Each create method is probably going to have some parameters that are unique to it. You'll see in our little library that we've shipped that the parameters vary quite a bit. Sometimes you're passing in a duration, sometimes you're passing in a speed or an acceleration or something very domain specific like the amplitude of a sine wave. And what's actually going on behind the scenes, though, is the transition interface that you get passed back. That's a system-owned object that can only be created by Windows Animation itself. But inside every transition, there is a little interpolator. And these are the objects that you can implement yourself if you want to add some new math. And the point of this design was that there's actually quite a lot of rich behavior going on in transition. And also, there's a common interface that we didn't want every application author or third party to have to implement over and over again. And the main things on it are the ability to override the initial velocity, if you want to have a sharp movement off in another direction, and even the initial value, if for some reason maybe you're animating a color or something, you just want a jump to something else as a new starting point when a new animation begins. And you can also see if the duration is known and find out what that is, which can be useful when you're building up a storyboard, making some decisions there. The IUI animation interpolator interface is actually quite different. And one key thing we wanted to do was make it as simple to implement as possible. And so by insulating it from applications are never supposed to call this directly, we can make all kinds of guarantees about what order the different methods are called in, and the fact that one method will always be called before another. And you don't need in your code to have all kinds of error checking. You can just assume that these things are true. And since this is actually the component that we want to be most performant, because we're going to be calling a lot of these every single frame of an animation, that's another reason why we want to keep it simple, aside from just being nice to external developers. And the most interesting thing about the interpolator is that there's obviously this key method, which is interpolate value. That's the thing that's driving the whole animation system when we're calling in at different slices of time and saying, what's your current value? What's your current value? But we also have interpolate velocity. We actually don't call that as much. We only call that when one animation is interrupting another one in the schedule. Although we might end up calling it multiple times as the schedule changes, things get canceled. But this is a case where you're actually going to have to use high school calculus. You need to provide the first derivative of your function. And assuming you get that right, then you'll automatically just see this smooth behavior when another animation interrupts your interpolator. And So we have in the SDK samples, we have a little program that does provide a custom interpolator. We deliberately pick something very simple, and so it's almost a derivative of one of the interpolators that's in the library already, but it just has a specific set of parameters and some specific behaviors.
So with our custom interpolator demo, what we do first is we just lay the photos out in a random position around the kind of the center of the client area. When you hit the up arrow, all of the photos seem to be attracted towards the top of the window here. And when we hit the down arrow, they'll be attracted to the bottom, and then spacebar will lay them out randomly in the middle again. And so what this custom interpolator is basically what we're doing is we're with a determined acceleration, we're accelerating towards a certain point, and then once we get there, we stop immediately. So there's no, all of the energy is consumed once it hits its position, so there's no bounce back or anything like that. And so the other cool thing, too, about this transition is we also have the velocity matching that we get for free because we supplied the first derivative of that function. And so once I start interrupting here, you can see how they move kind of up and down, and then they'll get to their final position. So if you want, we can show some code, see the actual API of...
Sure, we can walk through that a little.
Walk through that a little bit here. So here, this is our custom interpolator implementation for our attract interpolator. Some of the key methods to point out here is the set initial and the set initial value and velocity function. Here we determine basically what our acceleration looks like. And also we init some of the values here. Let's set duration. Get duration. Where's the interpolate value is the first function that you're going to have to implement. And this is where we use what's this one? The quadratic. This one.
Mm-hmm.
Can't remember. Yep. Yeah.
You use the correct math.
The correct math. Yeah. To calculate the value based on this offset, which is essentially the time parameter, and so this will calculate the value. So this will be the position of the object at a given certain time, and then also the other interesting function here is this interpolate velocity, and hopefully our math is correct. Is we actually took the first derivative of the previous function. And that is where you'll get the velocity matching, and then so all you really need to do is implement these two functions correctly, and the framework will handle the velocity matching and stretching and all that good stuff. Another thing to point out too is here. So as Paul said before, inside each transition is an interpolator, and so what you do here is you actually create the wrapper so that when you instantiate your custom interpolator, you actually instantiate a transition, and then the transition can be used in our framework just as if it was a transition that was out of the box. And so here we you create the API face of the values that you want to you want a developer to enter. So here we have the final value that it needs to go to, as well as the acceleration to get to that final value. But notice here that this is a context-sensitive transition, is that you don't supply a time parameter. And so that's where we pick up the slack there, and we'll calculate the time, and based on the initial value and the initial velocity, calculate the time and then create your interpolation for you.
And then finally, there's this get dependencies method. If you scroll up a little bit, and it's really important to get this right. This is where you're explaining what things depend on what in your math. So, does the initial value of the variable affect its duration? Does the initial velocity affect its final value, and so on? And so, this would be a good thing to look at closely in this sample, just to show what we did here, which of these flags we do set, And the key thing is that we don't say that the duration depends on the call to set duration. And because of that, the system simply will not call set duration method on this. And it's OK to just return efail, just to verify that, so that you're not getting called.
Cool. See, so like we said before, all of these samples are going to be available in the Windows 7 SDK. And you can find all of our help on MSDN and go through code samples, code walkthroughs, and look at the storyboarding. And also, we provide graphical representations of all of our interpolators that are provided in our transition library.
Yeah. And so, yeah, that's the walkthrough. Hopefully now we've given you some idea of why we did the things we did in this initial animation API that we're shipping. And we're hoping that this will enable developers to really take animation to another level in terms of richness in their applications. We scale to take very large storyboards. You can have one small thing, you know, move to one destination in an appropriate amount of time, and then using a keyframe, you can trigger a lot of other animations in response to that. And even as you make the animations in your application more and more rich, the user should be able to push keys as much as they want and should never feel that the animation is getting in the way. And so we look forward to seeing what you all do with it. Thank you.